Welcome to episode 449 of That Triathlon Show, the podcast presented by scientifictriathlon.com. I'm your host Michael, and on today's episode I interview Rob Cheatham. Rob is a South African triathlon coach based in Bath in the UK, and in today's interview we have a classic training talk episode with discussions around various aspects around training, but we also go into the specifics of Leon Chevalier's training leading into Kona, where he finished fourth, and Leon obviously being coached by Rob. But before we get into the interview, big thanks to our sponsors, Precision Fuel and Hydration. They create carbohydrate and electrolyte products that are effective, practical, and tasty. And whether it's a caffeine gel before a sprint triathlon to give you an extra boost, or a full-on carbohydrate and electrolyte strategy required for an Ironman, getting your fueling and hydration right can be the difference between achieving or not achieving your goal. And Precision Fuel and Hydration have products that make it as simple as it can be to get your fueling and hydration right. You can easily fine-tune your intakes to your carbohydrate, sodium, and caffeine requirements, ensuring that you get the most out of yourself on race day. Their gels, drink mixes, and chews are easy to digest, making them a reliable choice for any endurance athlete. You can get a free fuel and hydration plan for your next race with the Fuel and Hydration Planner on the Precision Fuel and Hydration website. And as a TTS listener, you can get 15% off your first order by using the code TTS24 on precisionfuelandhydration.com. Now, without any further ado, let's get into the interview with Rob Cheatham. Welcome to That Triathlon Show, Rob. How are you doing?
Hey, Michael. Yeah, really good, mate. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, it's really great to have you. I'm excited for this chat. So let's start with an introduction. Can you tell us a bit more about yourself and your background in triathlon and in coaching in general?
Yeah, sure. Thanks. So my name's Rob Cheatham. I'm half of Cheatham Coaching, along with my wife, Susie, who is a pro triathlete herself. We've been in coaching for just a little over a decade. Initially, my sort of background in coaching was my wife, Susie, transitioned from being an elite runner into triathlon. When she was following me, I was running around the world as an age grouper, doing Ironmans averagely, and Susie got bored of me disappearing on the weekends and never seeing me. So she bought herself a bike and started doing a bit of training with me. She did her first 70.3 and was pretty good at it. So she went pro the next day, and we sort of had to come up with our own coaching and training methodology based a lot on the scientific background that we utilized and had sort of gained through her running career. And it seemed to work. Susie became pretty good quite quickly. She won a bunch of 70.3s, top 10 in the 70.3 world champs. And then she packed it all in 2014 and went pro, left her job. Well, she was already a pro, but left her job to go all in for the Ironman world champs in Hawaii in 2015. And in her second ever Ironman in Kona, she came sixth at Kona. So that was a sort of a breakthrough race for her. And from that, I think we'd sort of grown the coaching organically. Our methodology grew organically through Susie's career, through friends and colleagues in the sport. A couple of people along the way asked us to coach them. And without really ever pushing it, it developed from there. So we then coached one or two pro athletes along the way. A really good friend of ours is pro athlete Nikki Bartlett. I think you've had Bex on your show before. And Nikki's excelling at the moment. Her and Bex are doing amazing things. But we coached Nikki in her early pro career, from the beginning of her pro career to her first Ironman win. And sort of as we achieved success with a few athletes that we coached, more people became interested. And yeah, organically, we've just sort of grown it from there. And now we coach Leon Chevalier from France, who's obviously had a really good performance over the weekend in Kona, coming fourth. Had amazing success with Leon, brilliant guy to coach. Probably talk about that a little bit later. We coach a few other French athletes, French pro Arnaud Giot, who was up until Kona lying second in the pro series, but unfortunately he had a DNF in Kona. And over here in the UK, we coach Harry Palmer, who's we've worked with this year. He's gone to his first win this year, plus his second win, and then in his last race he was second as well. So he's going really well. And then a bunch of new and upcoming pros, both here in the UK and in Europe and in America.
Yeah, thank you for that. And first of all, So do you and Susie, when you work as a team, how does that work? Can you describe a little bit more how you collaborate or work together when you're coaching athletes?
Yeah, absolutely. So again, I'm using the word organically a little bit too much, but it's just the reality is that most of what we do sort of isn't particularly planned on who works with who. It just is, for now, it's been where the fit has been best organically. And very often someone will come to Susie and ask to be coached by Susie. Sometimes people come to me and ask to be coached by me. Sometimes people get in touch collectively, and then we have a sit down with them and we decide who will be your number one point of contact. But overall, the methodology and the structure and the training, we decide collectively. So when we sit down on a Sunday and we go through our weekly plan for all of our athletes, we always have a chat about all of our athletes across the board. So there's input from Susie and input from me. So it's very much a collective.
Yeah, that's an interesting setup for sure. What about when you mentioned how your coaching methodology has developed organically? Can we get into that a little bit? What does that actually look like today?
Yeah, sure. So certainly on the pro side, and I know we're going to touch on the age group side a little bit later because we do coach a couple of amazing age groupers as well. But whenever we do take on a new pro, one of the things I always warn them about is that when we get into the meat of it, it's going to look surprisingly similar and surprisingly unremarkable. So most of the stuff that we do is not any groundbreaking nouveau technique that's being utilized this year or being the flavor of the month. Most of it is the same sort of stuff that you would have expected that the top guys would have been doing 10 years ago or 15 years ago in ultra endurance sport. So most of it is just a really healthy mix of endurance, speed, power, and technique. And most importantly for us is consistency. So whenever athletes come to us, very often when I look at their training plan or from previous years and their racing plan, and this is especially true for the pros, I see that they are racing too often. And when you're racing too often, you're not able to put the big blocks of training together to get your fitness up to the peak that you can achieve. So whenever my pros or age groupers go into an A race, one of the first things I talk about is how you've done in the last 14 weeks. And how you've done in the last 14 weeks and the consistency that you put down in the last 14 weeks, I think, is very often going to be crucial to how you perform. The exact mix of, speed, endurance, threshold stuff, is important, but it's less important for me than that you've put together 14 consistent weeks, in the lead up to your A race. And that for me over, coaching and spectating a couple of hundred races, for pros and age group is where I've seen the greatest correlation with success. So probably consistency would be the number one thing that I'd say is what we focus on.
Yeah, that's a great point. Is there anything else in the actual training content within that consistency that you tend to see maybe changes when you start working with a new athlete compared to what they were doing before typically?
Yeah. And the one thing that I would say is, I said, we're not into sort of new flavor of the month techniques. The one thing that we definitely have embraced in the last couple of years is the, I don't know whether you want to call it the polarized method or the Norwegian method, but we definitely have embraced the idea of, most of your running should be easy. And, this is not going to be news to most of your listeners. Anyone in endurance sport is, I think, at the top end is following this sort of methodology. Now, the vast majority of your weekly training load should be easy. Your hard stuff should be very specific and in that very specific sweet spot zone, which for us is just sub-threshold, but not over. That's the sort of 15% of your weekly volume you want to spend in that time. And you want to spend very little time above threshold in your normal weekly training because it saps your energy and you just don't get much more cardiovascular improvement by training at 101% of threshold than you do at 99%. So that's the very, very brief and oversimplified version of that's why we like to spend our time in that little zone. Very, very important. And then for us, speed work is there. We don't do as much speed work as some other coaches. But for us, speed work is either a strength workout or a technique workout. So if we do speed work, it's short, it's 400s, and it's not an enormous session, and it's not thrashing yourself to death in your 400 meter session. It's a strength session focusing on technique and working, using it to develop your muscular strength to support your endurance goals.
And is there any difference between the 7.3 distance and the Ironman distance if you have that as the main race that you're training for? Would an Ironman focused athlete be a little bit lower, a little bit farther from threshold, closer to Ironman race pace, or do you like that sweet spot of just below threshold for regardless of the distance within long distance triathlon?
Yeah, that's a really good question. So I think you hit the nail on the head. We are seeing some world-class athletes and superstars who are excelling right from the T100 distance up to Ironman. So it's clearly possible. And in fact, we're seeing people who can excel from Olympic distance up to Ironman. But in my view, there definitely is still a specialism for ultra-distance triathlon and Ironman specifically. And then exactly as you say, so a 70.3 athlete will certainly see more variability in their training. They're going to go into that. They are going to go into that lactic zone in a T100 or 70.3 race. So we would include lactic buffering, for example, getting your body used to flushing out lactic acid much more than you would an Ironman athlete, because an Ironman athlete in a well-paced race hardly ever, if ever, enters his lactic zone, other than possibly a little sprint out of T1 to try and catch the group.
Yeah, no, that makes complete sense. And then I want to ask about your swim squad, because I believe you're running a bit of a swim squad in you're based in Bath, I believe. So can you talk a bit more about that?
Yeah, we're really lucky here in Bath. We used to call it the Triathlon Valley, because in a tiny little valley here between where we live in a village called Bradford-on-Avon and Bath, which is about 10 kilometers away, the valley that runs between here and Bath, we used to call it Triathlon Valley, because we had everyone from GTN's Mark Threlfall, used to be ITU world champion Vicky Holland, her coach Reese, Leon, Susie, India Lee, we've got Harry Palmer, we've got new pro Freddie Webb. I don't want to leave anyone out and insult them. Who else have we had? Canadian Olympian Joe Brown. And there's probably a handful more that I'm missing out on the spot, all living literally in this little valley, which again just happened semi by chance and semi by design. So from the time when we moved in here, right through Indy getting into long distance triathlon, Susie arriving, 8 or 9 years ago, into the squad down here at the university. It's always been really collaborative. So we've always had different coaches, down here. We're all friends. We meet up for triathlon Christmas parties. When there's a new pro getting into, who's got their pro card, and they all face that inevitable, hump of trying to get sponsorship and kit and equipment, there's always someone to lend them a tri suit or an aero helmet. And it really works very well. So, long story short, we do have a squad now, a long distance squad. Up until last year, the long distance guys jumped in with the British Triathlon high performance squad. But this year we've separated away and we've got our own swim squad at the University of Bath. Mostly coached by me, but not exclusively. A couple of other guys who are coached by other coaches, and that's absolutely fine. And the intention there is not so much coaching input by me per se necessarily, but just giving the guys the consistency and a squad mentality of having a swim session in the diary every day for them to work their week around, because we think that's really important to give a sort of pro mindset, a professional mindset to the athletes. And that's pretty much where we are. So yeah, we got Freddie, Harry, Leon, a couple of really top age groupers on the border of getting their pro card, and a couple of new guys joining for next year as well. And it works really well.
And what was the reason for starting that squad, given that if they could already join the British Triathlon's elite squad and swim, was there a particular reason that did you want that extra specificity, or what was
the short answer? Is we got kicked out, and that's not negative on them or the coaches or whatever, but it's probably partly understandable that these things are funded by national bodies. And the argument, although I disagree with it, the argument could be made that a British Triathlon funded ITU focused squad shouldn't have 6 elite Ironman athletes taking up their lane space. I think that there's synergy there, and possibly, and it worked well for 7 or 8 years, but they've got their funding and budget constraints. So I'm sure that they've got their reasons and we understood them. So yeah, we got kicked out. So we had to find a new solution. And I'm sure similar to in Europe, swimming in the fitness lane at your local leisure center is not really a professional approach for a professional swimmer. So for a professional athlete. So yeah, by necessity, we conjured up our own lanes, procured them, and it's worked really well. And we're certainly going to continue with it next year.
Yeah, that's nice. So tell us about your view on triathlon swimming. What are the, for long distance triathlon specifically, what are the key things to consider when it comes to designing your training process, really?
So that's a big question. So, and I'd say that, and I don't think it's a controversial view, that I think the swim has become a lot more important in long distance triathlon and Ironman. I think that, you know, when I got into the sport 15 years ago and when Susie first got into the sport, there were still a lot of specialists, I don't mean to be insulting, but weaker swimmers who were bike and run specialists who would come through the field. And there always used to be the adage that no one's ever won Kona who's come out the swim first. And we're seeing that at world championships is certainly not the case anymore with Sam Laidlow's and Lucy Charles's around. So we're absolutely now seeing, in an era where everyone can swim well and there's a core group of world-class athletes in the men's and women's fields who can swim very well, if you're not out of the water within touching distance of those uber swimmers like a Lucy or a Sam, then it's going to make your day very difficult. So the days of being able to be world champion, I think, coming out the water 5 minutes behind the leader are numbered. So, and that doesn't mean that you have to be a Lucy or a Sam, but I think you need to be in touch. And all that means is massive focus if it's your weakness. So, you know, in our experience, for Leon, he wouldn't mind me saying that the swim is his weakness. Clearly he's a super biker and a super runner, and the swim is his relative weakness. So there's no hiding behind the fact that if he wants to be world champion, he's going to need to improve his swim. And we put in place a number of measures and interventions. One of which was having the consistency of the swim squad this year and focusing on specific things that he needed to improve on. And we actually set the goal this year of improving his Ironman swim time by 90 seconds, you know, comparable like for like. And that meant about three seconds per 100 in the pool for a like-for-like session. And we set about that, and we benchmarked a number of key things that we needed to do, and we set about doing that. And we said actually before the race that success looked like improving from losing 5 minutes to Sam at the last World Champs to losing 3.5 minutes to Sam at this World Champs, and that's exactly what he did. And there's still work to do. And if we can find another 90 seconds next year, we'll be well on the way to doing that. And I think another 90 seconds in the following 2 years, and I think we would be at the end goal of that project. But a lot of it means, you know, don't take the status quo for granted. We work with other swim coaches as well. There's certainly no, there's no fiefdoms, or empire building over the swim squad. If there's a swim coach that can help us, we'll get them in and we'll ask them to help us, which we are doing. And yeah, so in a nutshell, the swim is extremely important across the board, even in Ironman, if not more so in Ironman. And you're not going to be winning Kona or being a contender any longer, I don't think, without being a good swimmer.
And becoming a good swimmer, using Leon as an example, that's a good one, 90 seconds in 1 year. What did that look like? What are the key points there that you need to hit? Is there a certain amount of volume, certain amount of frequency, certain types of sessions that you do on a regular basis? Can you talk a bit more about that?
So the first thing for a pro specifically, but an age grouper as well, is absolutely you need to, and we're talking about people who are relatively weaker swimmer relative to their other disciplines. Absolutely, you have to nail down any technique weaknesses in your stroke. Any good swim coach or technique coach will tell you that whenever you look at a relatively weaker swimmer, there's going to be probably one of a list of four things that they're doing wrong. and you know, and very highly weighted to the top two or three areas that people do. And many of them won't be news to you or your listeners. You know, the sort of trademark cliched mistakes that people make in their swim stroke. So the first thing you have to do is get input and intervention on those and work on improving those, because there are going to be big limits to how fast you can potentially go if you've got fundamental things wrong with your stroke. So with Leon, we did that. We've started working on this in previous years, but at the beginning of this year, we identified one or two critical weaknesses with his stroke. And before we did any building, fitness development, anything like that, we did our very, very best to nail those one or two things wrong with his stroke. And we hammered it and hammered it and hammered it. And the one key issue that he had with his stroke, I'd say we've improved 80% from where it was before. So once you've taken care of those critical weaknesses to your swim stroke, you can then start looking at the structure of your training. But without a doubt, you know, again, sorry, Lucy, to use you as an example again, but you know, Lucy Charles could probably swim 3Ks twice a week, swimming steady, and she'd still be front to the front pack at Kona, because her stroke is incredible. And you see that as well with Olympic swimmers who come back after retirement, famous Olympic swimmers who have come back after 8 years of retirement. Once your technique is there, that's 90% of the journey. The fitness and the strength develops over time. So you have to do your best to improve that. It's not an inevitable that every athlete will be able to get to a 10 out of 10 stroke. But if you're a really weak pro swimmer and you've got a 6 out of 10 stroke, if you can improve to an 8 out of 10 stroke and technique, that's going to be a lot more of the battle than the quantity or type of your training.
And what are the four things that you think are most commonly the issues?
So the same sort of stuff as you'd see on any YouTube video about top freestyle swim tips. So crossing over in front of your head, arm plunging too low below the body, arm sweeping out to the sides. And those three all have the same impact on your body. And it makes your body wiggle. And a wiggly body moving through water is not a hydro-efficient body. So all three of those is trying to get your body as linear and on the plane so that whatever power you're applying with your hands going backwards is pushing in the right direction. So there's obviously a lot more to it than that. But yeah, effectively, anything that's making your pull phase of your stroke pushing in the wrong direction, or your body moving in the wrong direction, is going to make you a slower swimmer. So a lot of the stuff is rectifying those.
And what tools or interventions do you use for identifying issues and correcting them? Do you use GoPros to film underwater? Do you use drills, or do you try to correct within swimming? Can you talk a bit about that?
Yeah, a bit of both. So certainly video footage. For us, that means at the moment an iPhone and a waterproof iPhone under the water. So it doesn't have to be anything highly technical. And then identifying the problem and then just working on it lap after lap. So a certain amount of it is drills. But if you're trying to rectify an issue, like, for example, a wide sweeping arm, if you're lucky enough as an age grouper or a pro to have someone poolside, that's easy to spot. And you can just tell the person to be mindful and deliberate in a long, easy stroke, and just keep an eye on it and tell them, you know, bring it in more, bring it in more, bring it in more. And what you tend to find with swimming is, what your self-awareness is of what you're doing, just like many sports, is often very different to what you are doing. So very often, if someone does have a very wide sweeping arm and hand on the pull, very often they think they've brought it in right under their body and it's still only 50% of the way there. So having someone poolside to just point that out and show them the videos and review it, and then you go and try it again, is important. But on top of all of that, you know, me on poolside with my camera is important. And we've got good knowledge of swim technique training, and I come from a background as a swimmer. Also understanding that the limits of your expertise is important. So we bring in expert technique and stroke coaches to help with the guys.
This is a really interesting topic, actually. So who is an expert technique analyst, so to say? Yeah. Like, because there are a lot of swim coaches, but yeah, it's hard to correct technique and to really Yeah. Especially because everybody's different and different builds, different anatomy. So the perfect stroke can look quite different from one person to another.
Yeah.
So what are you looking for? What kind of person do you bring in to help with that?
You know, that's a really good question. So I think it's just experience. I don't think there's a clear answer to that. I think that that what will work for one athlete might not work for another. And there's lots of really good people out there. I think that it's understanding a person's credentials, knowing the person and developing a trusting relationship. And we've got a couple of people that we've got a trusting relationship with, some of which we're hoping to develop further into next year. But I don't think there's a textbook answer for that. I think it's just finding your way through and working out who you work best with.
Yeah, all right. And moving along to the fitness building aspect of swimming, what sort of key sessions would you consider the most important ones that you do on a regular basis within the squad?
So I would say that, again, it's going to be the usual mix of our swim squad weekly program would look very similar to a master's swimming group weekly program. Mix it up in the strokes, healthy mix of speed days, threshold days, VO2 days, but we also have easy days in there, just mindful swimming, really being, you know, long and deliberate in your stroke and thinking about what you're doing. But most of all, if you're asking for one specific session or day that we put the most value on, it's definitely technique. So, if an athlete is trying to make an intervention in the pro ranks, I think they need, certainly for a big chunk of the season, they need to be swimming every day. And close to 50% of that should be technique work, would be my view. If it's an athlete that's really trying to make a big change to their swim, it can't always be done. We've seen extremely good pro athletes who have gone their whole careers without being able to turn their swim around. So it's not a given. But there are also those who have been weak swimmers who have turned it around and become front pack swimmers. So it can be done. And I'd say the common denominator is those athletes have put a lot of time into their swimming, a huge amount of time in the off season, and a very big chunk of that has been technique focus.
Do you think there is a case to be made for those weaker swimmers that want to improve to spend a pretty large chunk of time, probably in the off season, where you really, really reduce the amount of running and cycling that you do to be able to actually make those improvements that you need to do in the pool?
Yeah, that's exactly it. But, right through the season as well. So, don't mean to keep invoking Leon, but he's fresh in our minds at the moment. So Leon wouldn't mind me saying Leon's simply trained more this year, throughout the whole year in the pool. So he's been swimming 6 times a week at least, and at times 7 times a week, even during the season. And in the off season, absolutely. Leon's the kind of athlete who he likes to have a real break at the end of the year. So he really does have a couple of months where he pulls back almost completely with, just very social training and stuff. But he's going to keep the swimming going. So I think even during that break, he might do almost no biking or running for a big chunk of time between now and Christmas and into January. But he will keep the swimming going at least 5 to 6 times a week right through the off season.
Mm. And final question about swimming. How do you view training in the open water? Is that an important part or not so much?
Yeah, definitely an important part. And once again, we're lucky enough with our core group of athletes here in the Valley that we've got a wonderful open water facility down the road from us. And once it gets warm enough here in the UK, which sometimes takes a little bit longer than the rest of Europe, then the guys and girls get in there at least once a week. So they're doing open water at least once a week. And although it's definitely not as good for the specificity or fitness improvement as you can get in a pool, there's certain skills that you can only learn out in the open water. And the nice thing about it is, as a squad, we can practice those things. So we can practice mass starts, we can practice swimming all over each other. And really crucially for the long distance game, we can practice pushing that, holding onto a toe and not letting the elastic snap. So we do quite a lot of that, of letting a weaker swimmer go behind a faster swimmer, crank up the pace and letting them go till you blow, as we call it, and just try and learn to hold those toes as long as you can, because as we all know, that can be absolutely crucial. The one thing I didn't mention earlier, you said what's improved in Leon's swim, and I'm circling back a little bit, but partly it's been down to the interventions that we've made and the deliberate way that we've gone about addressing his swimming. But without a doubt for him, who is definitely an Ironman specialist, racing T100 has been brilliant for his swim this year, because it's just absolutely pushed him into a new level of intensity that he has to race at. And what we just spoke about, learning to hang on to those toes for dear life and how important that can be of either making or breaking your race. I think that while in Leon's case, he may not be a T100 specialist just yet, I think that the dividends that it's paid in making him a better Ironman athlete was one of the unexpected benefits of the T100 racing. And I think that that paid dividends in Kona this year.
Yeah. No, that's really interesting to hear that perspective. And about the open water session, type of session that you described, I think personally, I think that's the best possible swimming session that you can do if you have to choose just one, because you are training the way you race, basically. And of course, there are advantages to training in the pool, but I think if you have the opportunity to train in the open water, and especially with a group, that can make all the difference.
Yeah.
But moving on to the next topic. So yeah, I do want to talk a bit more about Leon's fourth place, but before that, I want to ask some age group specific questions. So what would you say are the main differences between coaching age group athletes and professional athletes?
Yeah, so the obvious one is time. And that's not necessarily a clear cut answer, because as we all know, there are age groupers who train like elite athletes, and there are pros who have day jobs and need to manage their training around that. And we have both. We've got, we coach pros who have day jobs, and we have to manage their training and what to focus on and what's most important. And we've also got age groupers who train like Olympians. And, you know, I've got a huge amount of respect for both approaches. But in general, obviously, an age group is going to have other constraints of work and family and social pressures. So generally, there's going to be less time. So it's about focusing on what you can do and maximizing your utilization of time. If being as fast as you can be is your main goal, that's not every age group's goal. But if that is the goal, then yeah, maximizing the use of your time.
And how do you generally do that? Or what are the principles for maximizing one's use of time?
I think, firstly, and I would say this, but having a coach that is acutely aware of your schedule and your timetable, you know, I think that if you're a busy age grouper, more than ever, a templated approach might not work for you. If you're full-time and you're a pro, you can go and buy Joel Filial's book, and you can probably apply most of those training principles pretty well. As a pro, when you can manage your entire weekly schedule and fit things in and around what you need to do. But as an age grouper, having a coach who can have a look at your schedule, have a look at your constraints, and then maximize your use of time is probably one of the first things that I would do. But doing the most important things first, I would say. So, you know, and most of it is quite obvious, but you can't drop your long run or your long ride if you're going to be an Ironman athlete. So that's going to be the first thing that you put in on the weekend if you're hoping to do an Ironman. And that's for everyone from a pro to a 16-hour Ironman age grouper. You're going to need to do that weekly long run and long ride. If you miss too many of those, you're going to fail. So you can drop that one in first. After that, cardiovascular development sessions. So for us, your CV development session is your sub-threshold work. So although it's an oversimplification, spend as much time as you can in that key zone just below threshold, but not over. And those would probably be your two starting points. And then after that, you're into the more marginal gains of making sure that you improve yourself across your range on the bike, and improve your other core competencies on the run as well.
Yeah, no, that's a good overview. And within each discipline, if we go into some more details, could you give a couple of tips for each discipline, general tips that would apply to most typical age groupers, let's say, for how to improve their swim, their bike, and their run?
So for all of those, the first answer is, again, obvious: get a coach. I would say, and if you don't get a coach, get a program, and then stick to the program. And there are really good programs out there as well. So the good news is that on a platform like Training Peaks, you can now get really, really good programs loaded onto Training Peaks for not an enormous amount of money. So if you can't afford a coach, get one of those, but definitely do have a program that's in Training Peaks to hold you to account. So that's absolutely crucial across the board. On the bike, probably next to and as important, I would say, is having a coach, and the work that you actually do in terms of your fitness development is get a proper bike fit. And I always say to my to anyone who approaches us, if we have the discussion and you decide that coaching's not for you, take one piece of advice and go and see the best bike fitter that you can. And that's going to be the biggest bang for your buck that you can probably spend as either a pro or an age grouper. We continue to work with Matt Bottrell here in the UK. It's a relationship that we've had going back well over a decade. And there's absolutely no commercial agreement or arrangement between us. But in my view, he's simply the best in the world. So anyone, whether they're my athlete or another athlete who can get an appointment with Matt, that will save you more minutes than probably anything else that you'll just about do in your triathlon improvement mission. So get a bike fit. That would be the bike one. The run one, run is much more volume based than just pure volume based than cycling. Cycling is more technique based. It's more precise and specific. But running, you become a runner just by running more. So if you're the type of person who can fit two hours of running a week into your schedule, you'll be a better runner with three hours. So as an age grouper, try and have a look at your schedule. Little and often is just as good as once or twice and long. So if you can only afford to run 20 minutes six times a week, that's just about as good as running 1 hour twice a week, you know. So I didn't do the math there. That is correct. Yeah, so that's pretty close to as good. And a lot of people don't realize that. Don't throw the baby out with the bathwater because you can only afford a little bit of time a day to train. You know, get out and clock up those miles, because that's what's important in the run for the vast majority of us. On the swim, we already touched on it. Make sure that you intervene on that technique as early as you can. And that certainly doesn't mean that if you're a 55-year-old age grouper and you've been swimming badly for 30 years, you're not going to become a Sam Laidlow or a Lucy Charles. But if you can improve yourself from a 5 out of 10 swimmer to a 6 out of 10 swimmer, that's going to have a massive impact on your times. So do that and keep working at your technique. Really important. I've got one quick cheat for a weaker swimmer out there, which doesn't work for everyone, and most swim coaches would probably roll their eyes. But if you're a weaker swimmer and you're trying to improve at your Ironman, consider trying to see if you can swim breathe every four strokes in your race. And most people, when they try it for the first time, they'll think, oh, I can't go fast, or I'm struggling and my heart rate's too high. But very often, if you practice it and you keep practicing it, if you are the type of person who can slow your heart rate and your stroke rate down to the point where you can breathe every four, breathing only to one side, obviously, if you're breathing every four, you might find that the compromise of slowing down your heart rate and your stroke rate, you gain more from not breathing as often. So that's something that I did as a relatively average age grouper, but I got my swim down to the low 50s, always breathing every four. And I know a lot of weaker swimmers who are in the 120, 130 mark as age groupers. If they can find the space and the mindfulness and the zen state to be able to get calm enough to breathe every four, they'll swim faster. So that's one for people to try if they can. Although your coach will probably disagree with me.
That's a really interesting one. I haven't heard that one before. So yeah, but it definitely makes sense, because I think of the common stroke errors you mentioned, one that I think you left out was the breath. So yeah. I mean, that's such a common cause of issues in across the board, really,
that's even true.
For very good swimmers. So if you can take less breaths, and if that's a root cause of your issues, then that makes total sense that you might go faster.
And it takes, if you do try it, probably every one of your listeners, if they do try it, particularly if you're a weaker swimmer, I'm not talking about pros, pretty much on the whole. I'm talking about weaker age group of swimmers. If you do try it, the first time you try it, you'll think, this is horrendous. There's no ways I can do this. But if you keep trying it, you keep becoming more comfortable with the feeling of being hypoxic. You'll slowly develop your technique of how to get rid of all of your air slowly throughout the stroke and take in a really big breath, which lasts you through the four strokes. And if you can do that, you can get to the place where you can be at peace with breathing every four strokes, you'll probably be faster, because a weaker swimmer, more than anyone, you're losing time every time you breathe. Every time you pop your head up, it's not efficient for a weaker swimmer, and you're losing time. And if you can do that less often, you're going to be a faster swimmer over an Ironman, I think, quite often.
Mm, yeah, very interesting. What would you say are some quote-unquote things? So this can be, this is a very, I guess, all-encompassing term here. It could be training interventions, products, services, metrics and data, etc. That within an age group triathlon context, you would say are overrated and also underrated. So if you can pick maybe three examples that of things that are overrated, three examples of things that you think are underrated for an age group triathlete.
So definitely, I've already mentioned it, a bike fit is underrated. I would say if you're spending $5,000 on a bike, but you haven't had a bike fit, you'd be better off on a $2,000 bike with a bike fit. So absolutely, the most underrated thing you can do is get a bike fit. And it does need to be an absolute specialist, because the stuff that the best 10 guys in the world are doing in terms of bike fit, compared to a good bike fitter, is still chalk and cheese. There's an enormous difference. So one of those very, very top bike fitters in the world, get yourself an appointment with them. There's a long waiting list for most of them, but do it. That will be the biggest intervention that you can make in terms of bang for your buck, without a doubt. So that's most underrated. The second thing which I would say most underrated is a high performing triathlon suit. And most of us, again, listening to some of your previous guests, this isn't news to you or your listeners, but the difference between good tri suits and the best tri suits in wind tunnel testing can be as high as 20 watts. So, I've seen pro wind tunnel data from last year, between sponsors trying out new tri suits for pro athletes, and the difference between some suits they were trialing and the benchmark best out there in the business was 20 watts for certain pro athletes. So that's enormous, and a lot of age groupers overlook it, and a lot of them wear their local club tri kit. And I would say to you, if you're wearing just the tri kit that you get from as a handout from your local tri club, you're probably hemorrhaging quite a few watts. So if you can spend a few hundred dollars on the best tri suit that you can afford, that's probably going to be the next biggest bang for your buck you can spend on equipment, I would say. So those are two underrated. Overrated, this one's a controversial one, specifically because I've got a lot of athletes who I coach who really, really believe in it. And I wouldn't say that our views diverge, but the obsession with high carb over the last couple of years, and people using 110, 120, 130, 140, 150 grams of carb an hour. I absolutely buy the science that in the last 10 years, we've learned that your body can metabolize more carbohydrate than what we used to think that it can. But it's definitely it's a diminishing return curve. So, and it's just important for athletes to know that, yes, it would be beneficial to take 100 grams of carb over 80 grams of carb if your body can absorb that amount, but crucially, if your body can absorb that amount. But it's important to know that you are gaining 80 or 90% of the effect quite low down already at the 50 grams of carb. And the gains become much less once you get up to 100 and 110 and 120. You might be, if you're a pro athlete and you're looking for that final 0.5%, then yeah, let's keep pushing to see exactly how many grams that you can take. But I've seen far more age groupers and a few pros having their races ruined, standing on the side of Ironmans, vomiting into the gutter because they've taken on too much nutrition, I think. So by all means, go high carb, but make sure you've trialed it in your training and that your body can absolutely handle that amount of carbohydrate. Because, you know, if we go back to the guys who were racing extremely well just 10 years ago, the big fights between Macca and Crowe, those guys were fueling at a third of what the guys are fueling at now. And they still went pretty fast and still did pretty amazing things. We've got a really famous ultra distance run in South Africa. I don't know if you've heard about it, called Comrades Marathon. This Comrades Marathon is still pretty much the world championships of ultra distance running. No matter what the trail guys say, that's pretty much the world championships. And, you know, we had guys in the 80s breaking 50K and 50 mile world records, which stood until a year or two ago. And they were running 90Ks on Coke and nothing else. And they were setting world records, which stood until pretty recently. So you can achieve the vast majority of your performance at half the carbs that some of the pros are doing. So just bear that in mind. You don't have to jump straight from being one gel an hour to, okay, I can see what the top pros are doing. I need to do 130 grams an hour. Ramp it up, do it in training, make sure that you can absorb it, and then that's the way to do it.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. I think the things always tend to go a bit in cycles, and I think we came out of a cycle where there was a lot of talk about fat adaptation and all of low carb, fasted training, all of that, and then it went straight into extremely high carb, and usually the truth is somewhere more in the middle.
Yeah.
And yeah, I agree with you. Like, there's a diminishing return. There is potential benefits from going higher, but you also need to be much more precise and know exactly what you're doing. There's more, less margin for error when you try to push above 100 grams. So you need to be well prepared to do that.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, we know an athlete, a pro athlete who was having his performances limited because he kept having gut issues in races. And he was, you know, of the view that you had to be at least, you know, 1.2 grams per kilo as a starting point. And he ramped that right back. Right. And, you know, I won't say exactly what numbers, but right back to something that, you know, a lot of pros nowadays might be shocked with. And he's racing brilliantly at a much lower amount of carb. So, if you can do it, brilliant. But if you can do it methodically, tested, great. If you can't, don't as an age grouper, don't think that you can't race well on 50 grams of carb per hour, because you can.
Mm. Yeah, I also want to comment on the second point you made there about the tri suits, because I completely agree. But at the same time, from the club perspective, I think this is something that clubs should consider. They should maybe have their cheaper offer, but also a more expensive but high performance tri suit in their like customized club kit, because I think it's a good thing for the sport that obviously that the clubs exist and that there is community and that it's not a solo effort, that triathlon can be a team sport and clubs are a big part of that. But at the same time, you have people that want to do both. They want to be part of a club, but they also want to bring the absolute best out of themselves.
Yeah.
So I think that there could be a market for clubs to offer different types of suits for different athletes.
And one of the issues is availability as well. It's quite a dark art coming up with a good tri suit. I've seen manufacturers spend a lot of money on R&D, coming up with, on the face of it, is going to be an incredibly good, fast tri suit, and then it goes into the wind tunnel and it doesn't work. So unfortunately, some of it is a bit of a dark art, and there are probably, if I was recommending a tri suit to a new pro that we work with, there's probably three or four suits in the world that I would say are at the absolute pinnacle of being a world-class tri suit, where you're losing no time to your competition. So for your average guy,
can you name those suits?
Most of them you can guess, but there is literally probably three or four where you could be confident that you're not losing any watts to your competition. And then after that, it's obviously a sliding scale. But unfortunately, not every tri club can either afford or even get availability of all of those suits. So I know that reality has to hit the, has to come into play. But a lot of really good ones are certainly available off the shelf, really good ones. And you may not have exactly as fast a suit as Sam Laidlow, but you know, you can get a suit where within 5 watts of that, pretty readily available.
Yeah. Then let's move on to talk a little bit about Leon's fourth place in Kona. So, or in particular, because everybody's probably watched the race or saw some highlights. So I want to talk about the training, which is really interesting to hear about. First of all, just a simple question about his overall training volume. And if you talk about the last 2 to 3 months leading up to the race or so, what would you say was his typical weekly volume across swim, bike and run?
Yes. So Leon's, I would say, amongst the top 10 in Kona as a cohort. He's not a high volume athlete. He probably sits somewhere between the middle and the lower. If you did a snap poll of the top 10 guys in Kona, he goes above 30 hours a week, swim, bike and run, but rarely. You know, that might be in a training block up in the mountains, where they'll put 2 big weeks in and they'll go just over 30 hours. But there's definitely no 40-hour weeks, that's for sure. And, you know, we're just talking swim, bike, and run here, not including S&C or stretching or what some of the guys include. So I'd say he's a mid to low volume athlete. One thing about Leon is he more than probably any other athlete that I've worked with is he gets fit very quickly. So I started the program by saying that consistency is key, and for Leon and all other athletes, consistency is key. And definitely when Leon's put together 11 good weeks leading into Kona, he performs better than 10. And if he's put 12 good weeks leading into Kona, he performs better than at 11. And that's true for all athletes. But Leon does get fit quicker than most other pros and age groupers that I've worked with. So he started this Kona build probably in a worse place than we've been before any other world champs that he's done. 12 weeks before, on social media, your listeners may have seen, a few of our boys went up into the Alps for a training camp and they all got COVID. And one or two of them managed to sort of shake it off, but a couple of them got hit quite hard by it and it knocked them out for 2 to 3 weeks. And, so I think 12 weeks before Kona, Leon came out of his 2 or 3 weeks hiatus after COVID. And, we actually had a sit down and we spoke about, well, what are we going to do for Kona? And we were both a little bit despondent about the amount of time left and where his fitness had gotten to. But we said it could be done. And if he absolutely nailed, the next 8 weeks of training leading into his taper, that he could have a strong result. But, needless to say, for both him and me, he wouldn't mind me saying that he exceeded our expectations, by his performance in Kona. Certainly from where he was 12 weeks before.
And so when he's not in the mountains, when he's back home, what would you say that on average his weekly volume would be?
I'd say, again, when we're into the last 10 weeks, not including taper, and we do throw in a little bit of a pullback recovery week. We wouldn't say it's every 2 or every 3 weeks we do it, you know, according to how the athlete's developing with their fatigue. But so not including a recovery week or taper, you're peaking at 28 to 30 hours a week of swim, bike, run. And sometimes when the athlete's feeling good and things are going well, we might tip that to 31, 32 or 33 hours, but not much more than that.
Yeah. And key sessions, we already touched on more in a general discussion, I think, but can we go into it a bit more specifically for Leon and leading into Kona? Key sessions, especially bike and run, might be really interesting to hear some specifics about the key ones that he did.
Yeah, and there's not a great amount of detail more than that. That you know, make sure that we make sure that what we're doing is serving a purpose. So long runs are very slow. Leon quite literally does long runs sometimes at 6 minutes a K, and I love that because when I coach age groupers, I coach 4 hour marathon runners who won't run at 6 minutes a K, and I can show them a snapshot of a session that Leon's finished, and I can say, Leon's doing his runs at 6 minutes a K. You can do yours at 6 minutes a K. So the long runs is about fatigue resistance. You know, it's not about cardiovascular development. So you're achieving almost as much by going out for a 3 hour plod at 6 minutes a K as you are at 5 minutes a K. So, and the additional recovery required at 5 minutes a K compared to 6 minutes a K isn't worth it. So that's a key session for us. It's always the long run, but it's always easy. And we've already touched on the sub threshold work. We just do loads and loads of sub threshold work, a few times a week, we've got something called the towpath, which goes up and down the canal. Here, you guys have got similar in Europe, nice and flat and consistent. We just spend a lot of time going up and down that just below your threshold on the run. We've also got the use of the university, track club. And a lot of our guys do track and threshold session, track and tempo sessions a couple of times a week, which is brilliant. It breaks it up. It brings a social element into it. The guys can go as fast or as hard as they want to, as hard or as easy as they want to. So we do include athletic club sessions for most of our athletes that train here in the Valley, either once or twice a week. That's on the run. And on the bike, the key difference, I think, to some coaches, maybe most coaches that we start, sorry, most athletes that we start working with, pro and age grouper, they find the bike sessions very hard. and we make no apologies for that. Most of them come back to me after the first few sessions and say, could we just quickly talk about this? Are you sure that this is the warm-up? Very often the warm-up's a bit quicker than the zone two that they're used to. And certainly when we exercise them across their range and their top end, we work very, very, very hard on the bike. We may not do as much volume as some of the guys on the continent. But we do a lot of fall off the bike sessions. I'd probably leave it at that without going into too much proprietary detail. But the guys work extremely hard on the bike across their range.
Can you give one example of a session on the bike that you do without giving?
Really simple, which is both a lactic buffering and a cardio and a CV development session, is letting the guys go VO2 on the bike. So going right up into your sort of VO2 max zone, 108, 110% on the bike for a couple of minutes, gasping for air, and then you come down, but you don't come down. You come down to either a short sweet spot burst of around 8 minutes, or you keep going for a 20-minute 70.3 or a half an hour Ironman effort or whatever it is. So it's going lactic and then coming down and not being able to get your breath, but keeping going with something that's more race specific or CV development specific. So we do a lot of that, and lots of work at VO2 max on the bike. So contradicting what we do on the run, where we don't like to go above threshold too much, we do a lot of work 2, 3, and 4 minutes at VO2 max. And lots and lots and lots until the guys want to fall off the bike. And a lot of work on the turbo. So I probably should say that. So partly living in the UK here, it's inevitable that you're going to spend time in the turbo, but a lot of the guys are opting to go on the turbo. Leon certainly loves it, and he does a very, very, very big chunk of his cycle work on the turbo trainer.
How many minutes of VO2 work would you typically aim for in a session? 20, 25?
I wouldn't say that there's a number. It's it really depends on where the athlete is with their week and their progression. It could be as short as if you're just trying to keep your body moving. You've got a race coming up soon, end of the season. You're just trying to do fitness maintenance, but you're not trying to mess with your blood fitness too much. It might be 4x2 minutes at VO2 or 4x90 seconds at VO2 max. When you're really trying to push on in the peak season, you might be doing a lot more than that. But it really does vary. I wouldn't be able to give you a number of a session.
Yeah. And the run, sub-threshold runs, what would an example be of a sub-threshold run for Leon?
And Leon's got his favorites, which aren't necessarily my favorites. We do very big, long 2-hour sessions of 3 on, 3 off, for example, where we 3 minutes at sub threshold, typical over under sessions, 3 minutes on, 3 minutes off. We do much longer efforts of, the guys have gone right up to 6x5K, before, in a key block of trying to improve cardiovascular fitness 5 or 6 weeks before an A race. So yeah, guys have gone right up to 6x5K in that sub-threshold zone. And there's a little bit of range in sub-threshold. I think the Ingebrigtsen brothers might be much more pinpoint about it, but we call that range anything from sort of 94 to 99% of threshold, trying to achieve different things within that zone. But so right up to 6x5K and right down to 3 on, 3 off. And very often we'll even do 800s on the track for a pro athlete, and the intention will be to be just below threshold, even for 800s on the track, which will be quite, that would be quite foreign to most athletes. But yeah, we'd be quite happy very often to be doing 15 times 800 on the track at 99% of threshold.
When you do something like 6x5K, that I assume would be more like around marathon pace, which is still a fast pace for a very well-trained athlete, or even Ironman pace, would you say?
Yes. I mean, I off the top of my head, I couldn't say what the pace would be, and it would vary for athletes. But as I said, where there's a range for us of what that sub-threshold is, 6x5K would clearly be at the lower range of what that sub-threshold work would be. But it's in that zone.
Yeah. Was there anything else in Leon's preparation, key aspects like heat preparation, bike tech, nutrition, or anything else that you would consider important and interesting to talk about?
Nothing revolutionary this time in terms of new interventions or, you know, new things that we've tried. The one thing about him and athletes in general, I think, is you need to be comfortable within your training environment. And I know with Leon, and I know with closer to home with Susie through her career, and it sounds like an obvious point, but training camps are great and they have their place. But certainly with those two athletes who I know and work with very, very closely, they both like being at home where things are familiar, where your swim squad time is always the same, where your grocery and food delivery service is reliable and you know what you're going to be eating. And you know who's going to be turning up for the track session. All of those things. So familiarity, I think, is important for a lot of pro athletes. And I think that Leon really craves that, and he tends to train really well when he's here at home. So gallivanting around the world as a pro triathlon tourist is great, and it's part of the lifestyle. But also making sure that you're in an environment where you can thrive is important as well.
Yeah, I think that comes down a little bit to what you mentioned earlier as well, around a lot of athletes that you start working with having raced too much to get in those training blocks. And yeah, it's not just the race, of course, but the travel itself that takes away from your available time to train. And the same does happen if you try to fit in a bunch of races in a year and then go on 2, 3, 4 training camps. If you have a home environment that is set up to be conducive to do the training that you can do, then you're able to get in more training simply. So
yeah, exactly. That's a great point. And it's quite funny. We love it where we live, but it wouldn't be your stereotypical training mecca. You know, if some of you guys came from Europe to come and visit us, you'd probably find the roads quite busy, quite dirty in the winter. It's quite muddy, twisty and turny. Not very good for long sustained time trial efforts here in the English countryside. So it's not your stereotypical Mallorca or Lanzarote training environment, but it just so happens that it works for quite a lot of athletes that live around here. So it's find what works for you, and it's not just limited to the paths and roads that you can train on. It's also the infrastructure and the environment, which makes your life easier.
This question is not on the list that I sent to you, so I apologize for that. But what about tapering into Kona? What did Leon's taper look like?
So very similar to what we always do. There are lots of different ways to taper. We have a strong view of how to taper, and it's again a discussion that I have to have with my pro and age groupers alike. And sometimes they have a view, I have a view, and then we meet in the middle. The tendency for elite athletes is they tend to want to stay more active later. As a coach, I believe in a longer taper and more rest and recovery at least in the 2 weeks before an A race Ironman. And I will always fly the flag of a easier taper. But very often the athletes that I work with will get anxious and they'll want to do more work in the last 2 weeks. And there seems to be a tendency amongst some of the leading men and women in the world that they are still running around Kona working very hard in the 3 or 4 days before the race. And I think that becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy as everyone tries to emulate that. But I still believe in a really, really relaxed taper. And Leon pretty much followed that, largely easy in the last 2 weeks. So he arrived in Kona 2 weeks before, having done and dusted the last of his preparation. And once he got to Kona, keeping it just like most people would be familiar with, keeping the intensity but lowering the volume a lot, and making sure you get lots of time to rest and recover and dump some of that fatigue that you pick up traveling halfway around the world as well. That's really important.
So do you know roughly off the top of your head what the volume would be in the week before race week and then in race week until the race?
Yeah, so certainly in 2 weeks before the race, you could definitely say that you brought the volume down by at least a third from 3 weeks before the race. So 2 weeks before, we come down a little bit 3 weeks before the race from peak weeks or weeks 4 and 5 before the race normally. Come down a little bit in week 3 before, and then the second week before, You come down at least a third from there. So probably 40% at least from your peak volume. But if an athlete wanted to come down 50% from their peak volume, I'd have no problem with that in week two before the race. And in the final week, as little as you want is the coach's advice. At that point, the athlete should be making sure that they feel recovered. And if they don't feel recovered, they should either spend the day on the sofa or just do some really light activation work and activation sessions. If you're feeling fatigued in race week, then you should, this is possibly more important for age groupers, take a duvet day, recover, try and dump some of that fatigue and just try and do some mobility, try and do some activation work, some strides, some running technique stuff, just really low impact stuff that keeps the body moving but doesn't add any fatigue.
Yeah, I 100% agree with that. And especially for age groupers that might still be working a full-time job Monday to Wednesday or Monday to Thursday, and then fitting that in with bringing the bike to the shop for a little tune-up, packing it, flying out, all of those things that add stress. So I definitely think that being erring on the side of resting rather than training is,
you know,
how I would approach it as well.
As a poignant example is, I think we've been to Kona 7 or 8 times, and I'm not saying this to criticize age groupers who do it, because it's a wonderful once-in-a-lifetime experience to go to Kona and, you know, engage in all of the myth and the legend of Kona. But pretty much every year you'll see the Wednesday or even the Thursday before Kona, guys doing the ride out to Harvey and back. And I can assure you, for a pro or an age grouper alike, doing 180 Ks on the bike the week before your Ironman isn't the right thing to be doing. So although it's lovely to go up to Harvey and have a salmon bagel, just have a think about what you want to get out of your race on Saturday and whether that's the best thing to be serving that after all the hard work that you've done. And the answer is no.
Yeah. Final question about Leon's preparation. Was there something that you would consider particularly successful that worked really well and that you would, let's say, double down on for next time, and vice versa? Was there something that maybe you would change or do differently next time?
Stuff that's worked well, focusing on the swim. So this is the first year where we've been really, really dogged about working on his swim, and we're going to double that down next year. And we've got some people that we're going to be working with next year. Sometimes the interventions can come from places that you didn't expect. And without a doubt, we've seen Leon's run improve this year. And you may have seen that following his races, but maybe the improvements aren't as evident to what we've seen in training about how much his running's improved. And a lot of that's come from working with the athletics squad up at Bath University, going twice a week and running free and enjoying himself and doing the set sessions with people of all athletic abilities is something that's been really good for him to have in the diary and to be a little bit of a release valve of the rigid structure sometimes that I set him of very specific paces and times and targets. And it's not something that I would have envisaged, you know, 18 months ago, setting out his course to Kona, but it's worked really well for him. So I suppose if you want to copy that across to an age grouper, exact watts and paces is important, but if you can find an athletic squad which motivates you and like-minded people around you to push yourself once or twice a week, that's good. Likewise for the swimming, if you can find a master swimming group which, although they're doing, you know, pool-specific swim sessions that can push you, that could be worth looking into. So that's worked really well for Leon, and it's definitely something that we'll keep going with next year.
Nice. And is there anything that you would do differently?
Anything that we would do?
You don't have to find an answer, because the race went really well, obviously.
Yeah. So I'm trying to think. I think that the plan is good. I think we continuing to every year. So with any athlete, I think if you're continuing to improve every year quantifiably, then you might argue you're on the right track. And I think we'd probably both say that was that we've been working together for 4 years. We're going into our fifth year, and every year we're making quantifiable improvements across all three. So if we can keep doing that, then I think that it'll put him into really good stead to challenge for an even better position in Nice next year. And probably the one thing that he or any other athlete could do to improve would be even more consistency. So this year, he did incredibly well with the 10 weeks that he got before Kona. But I would argue that 13 weeks would have been better. So if he could do that with 10 weeks, I'd love to see what he can do with the same consistency and focus for 13 weeks. And who knows what that would mean.
Yeah. To finish off, I have a few reflective questions for you. So the first one is, how do you learn and improve your coaching craft?
I think most important for any coach or just anyone in life in general is don't be dogmatic. Don't think that you got all the answers. Be flexible. And, you know, a couple of the key wins and gains that we've touched on already chatting here today, I wouldn't have expected 18 months ago. Very often they just pop up in front of you. You take an opportunity and it works. So yeah, just be flexible. Don't think you've got all the answers. Listen to other perspectives. You might throw 90% of those ideas and perspectives out the window, but if one out of 10 sticks and improves your craft, then that's worth doing. So I think that's a good lesson in general for coaching and for life. That would probably be the only one that I'd pull out.
And is there something that you're trying to learn more about or focus on at the moment or recently or in the near-term future, something specific topics or something?
So I personally find the way that we develop blood fitness fascinating. And I know that a lot of the debate around blood fitness and red blood cells starts to raise flags about doping and EPO and stuff, ways of doing that synthetically. But I'm quite fascinated about how the body develops cardiovascular fitness and when we stimulate red blood cell growth in the training cycle and try to make sure that you get the timing of that right. And incorporate that into your timing of the taper. So that's something that I've been enjoying finding out more about and something that I want to be more focused on going into next year. And that brings in all sorts of elements like altitude training, altitude timing, you know, the pitfalls of coming down from altitude too late or too early. But it's a subject which, in terms of the research, is not that well understood. There's a lot of commonly used knowledge, which I think is wrong. And it's an area that I'm quite interested in. And I think that improving and continuing to read and understand how that works is something that I'd like to improve on as a coach and incorporate more into our training going forward.
Yeah, that's really interesting. Just one quick follow-up on that. Mm. So what is something that you think is commonly used knowledge that might be wrong? Can you give an example of that?
So altitude, for example. So just and some of this is in the common sphere. So some people will say, oh, I know that's obvious. But I mean, I know a lot of pro athletes who are still doing a big altitude camp, coming down 2 weeks before a race and not considering that they may be in a really dangerous zone for the body reacclimatizing from coming down from altitude, and then understanding that it's not the same for everyone, and the physiological mechanisms, understanding the physiological mechanisms which cause athletes to hit a bit of a speed wobble once they come down from altitude. So that's not very well understood. A lot of athletes just think, well, at some point this year, I'm going to go to altitude for 3 weeks and that's going to work for me. I would say in most cases, that's not the case, and you'd be better off spending your time at home working on your fitness than going up into the Alps in a time when it's not going to be specific to your race. So that's probably one of them. And then the other one is not understanding how your blood fitness develops and wanes means that a lot of athletes get their taper wrong. Understanding without going into a deep conversation about physiology, but understanding that your body doesn't just magically develop red blood cells from a big training session or physical intervention. It takes time. And for a good number of days, possibly weeks, those baby red blood cells are not doing anything. They're not helping your body. They're not carrying oxygen to your muscles. They're just floating about in your blood volume, adding mass to your blood volume, but not actually carrying any oxygen. So understanding that when you're working really hard and you're at your peak training, in the short term, you're actually reducing your cardiovascular fitness. And then when it comes time to taper, you need to time that right so that all of those lovely red blood cells that you created 2 weeks ago come online in time for your race, and you haven't shedded too many of the ones that you've already got in time for race day. So that's a very pricey, version of where I think people's thinking should be in understanding cardiovascular fitness development and the taper and timing of your races.
Yeah, interesting. And if you could go back in time to earlier in your coaching career and give yourself some advice, what would you tell yourself?
Maybe get into it a bit earlier. So I probably didn't say in my introduction, actually, I did 20 years in the military before this. So I only retired last year from the British Army, even though I'm a South African, as some people might have picked up. I spent 20 years in the British Army. I had a wonderful time in the army, but obviously coaching whilst you are in a full-time military career meant that it was always a side hustle for me. And I coached some wonderful athletes alongside, but I'm really enjoying it as a full-time career now. And having known some of the how much satisfaction and enjoyment and success that we've had already, I probably would have done it a bit earlier. So that's probably the only thing.
And choose one of the following questions. Either the best or most influential book or books that you've read, or the best advice that you've ever received.
I think I'll go for best book, and that is by a South African called Tim Noakes, who many of you who follow endurance sport podcasts and science. He's he's largely retired now, but he's certainly one of the eminent endurance sport and run specific academics in the world. Dr. Tim Noakes from South Africa, and he wrote a book called The Law of Running, and I think the original edition came out over 25 years ago. But it's have you ever seen it by any chance?
Yeah, I have. Yeah, I have. Cool. And it's been mentioned several times before. Yeah, cool. Actually, yeah.
Yeah, so it's it's enormous. Off the top of my head, I think it's about 1,000 pages or more, but it's probably two Bibles thick. But everything that you could possibly know, particularly with some of the new amendments, anything that any amateur enthusiast, if you want to know about fitness development, tapering, science behind how weight affects run pace and performance and speed, and it's all in there. It's a brilliant place to start for anyone who's an amateur enthusiast on endurance sport, but running specifically. So definitely that one.
Excellent. And finally, Rob, thank you so much for this. And tell the listeners where they can follow you and your coaching.
Thanks, Michael. Yeah, we don't have a very big social media presence, something I probably need to work at going forward, which I think you probably found out trying to get hold of us. We're a relatively small squad, but if anyone wants to follow what we get up to, follow Cheatham Coaching on Instagram. That's probably the easiest way to see what we're getting up to and to contact us.
Yeah, excellent. Thanks so much. It was great to chat to you, and hope to do it again another time.
Thanks, Michael. Nice to see you.
I hope that you enjoyed that interview. As always, you can find the show notes on scientifictriathlon.com, and I've linked to some related episodes, in particular the recent episodes with Casper Peterson and with Nikki Bartlett and Bex Mills, where we also had some discussions around training leading into the Ironman World Championships for respectively Magnus Ditlev into Kona and Nikki Bartlett into Nice. So those might be interesting for you if you enjoyed this one, and in particular the segment around Leon Chevalier's training. So check that out. And before we close off this episode, I want to give you some training camp updates. First of all, remember that we have two training camps next year. We have our Mallorca camp from the 5th to the 12th of April, and the Portugal training camp in the Algarve from the 26th of April to the 3rd of May. And the idea of these training camps is that you get to train and live the lifestyle of a full-time athlete for a week, minus all the boring things, the chores like cooking and shopping for groceries and so on. So it's the most fun way to spend a vacation week that I can think of. You get to train in some beautiful places, and I really believe that this has a positive impact not just on your mood and your mental state and mental health, but also on your ability to adapt to the training. And of course, you will go home from the camp with a great physical boost in fitness, perhaps with some improved technique as well, and definitely with lots of learnings from the interactions with us coaches and also with all the other participants at the camp who all have things to contribute with. Probably the best of all, definitely the best of all, is that you get to do all of this in a positive and supportive social environment with lots of like-minded people. So lots of us are used to doing most of our training on our own, but it is just really nice to get to escape from that for a week and train in a group of people,
have that social interaction for the training that you're doing, and just get to enjoy it and enjoy it with people that love the same, have the same passion that you do for the sport. So I just cannot emphasize enough how great that is. If you haven't experienced it, you definitely should give it a try. You can read more about the camps on scientifictriathlon.com. And if you have any questions or want to register, you can simply email me on michael@scientifictriathlon.com. And I hope to see you in 2025 on one of our training camps. In the next episode, I interview Sam Proctor, who is the coach of India Lee. So we get some insights into the training of another very prominent athlete from this year. So stay tuned for that. And finally, big thanks to our sponsors, Precision Fuel Hydration, that you can find on precisionfuelandhydration.com. If you're looking for high quality, practical and tasty fueling and hydration products, make sure to try Precision Fuel Hydration. There are a range of options from drink mix to gels to choose, so you can easily find your personal favorite. And don't forget to take 15% off your first order with the code TTS24. Thank you, as always, for listening. Keep training smart and keep loving triathlon.